shouted that the siege against Yemen must be ended immediately. This war must end, and Yemeni people should be allowed to make decisions for themselves. In addition, we're one of the countries which is standing against the Americans and Zionists. We're part of the resistance movement in confronting the American and Zionist plots. Of course, it is a price, and we are paying the price of this resistance. We have to work together with different countries, and at the top of them, the Islamic Republic of Iran. As I told you previously, the war is not on Yemen only. They don't want Yemen to become a powerful country in the region. They see it as a threat against Zionist and American projects. We don't forget this, and we will remember this all the time. We are there because many world powers and some regional countries are targeting the Islamic Republic of Iran and the resistance movement. So we need to join hands and be united, based on an Islamic aspect, not only from a national point of view. We must not be ashamed of that, rather be proud of that. So we must not surrender to this media and its psychological warfare led by the West. We are Muslims and sons of one nation. We all belong to one nation, and this is our slogan. It has been our slogan since day one. Nothing can stop us from resistance. Nothing can prevent us from being united and against these aggressions. When we look at the reports published by them about the Islamic Republic of Iran, it's full of baseless claims that Iran is interfering in Yemen's affairs, internal affairs. However, it is not true. The same holds true about Yemen. It is not imposing anything on the Islamic Republic of Iran and its internal affairs. We see that in other countries, such as in Syria as well, Iran is not interfering there by no means. They know it well, and they know the brotherhood among Muslim nations, but they keep spreading rumors and lies against the Islamic Republic of Iran and also Yemen.
Well, it's because they've never experienced this relationship. It's always been that we are the masters. We tell our puppets what to do. We'll give them money. And whenever it's necessary, we change this one for that one. So, you know, as they say, some people imagine everybody is like them. So they can't even imagine. They can't even imagine the fact that you would have a nation, the Islamic Republic. Iran is a nation that rose up against its own dictator. The rule in Iran is based on the will of the people. We have elections. The people decided. The government in Iran doesn't exist because the Americans or the Russians or the Chinese are supporting it. And this is exactly what the Saudis, the Emiratis, and their Western backers, they fear this. They are scared of this, that this could be a model, that if the Saudi people, the people living in Saudi Arabia, the people living in Emirat, and it's interesting, you can't really talk about the Emirati people. There's very few Emiratis. Yes, maybe we can talk about Saudi Arabia being a people separate from their ruler. They're scared. They see this happening in a place like Yemen, which is unfortunately also, you know, maybe less wealthy, doesn't have all the money that they have, and they're scared that this could become a model for the other Arab countries, and that they might rise up against their dictators one day. So it's, I think, really, and if you think this is incorrect, please tell me so. I think a lot of it, besides the issue of strategic, Bab al-Mandab, all those things, I think a lot of it is just they have fear of having popular governments in the region. When you see a country like Yemen with that, you know, thousands of years of history, with that civilization, one of the centers of civilization in our part of the world, when they see that these people are going to establish their own government, they, of course, immediately are scared. Exactly what we saw happen in Bahrain, when the people in Bahrain, they didn't even want a republic. They said, please just change the prime minister after 41 years. They can't handle that people would have a government that comes from themselves. This is what they fear, maybe. And this is one of the motivations why they are keep trying to, you know, kill and destroy and continue the war. Because they fear that this model could be adopted by the Saudi and by the Emirati and by the other Arab peoples. Your insight on this issue, please.
لا أنا أتفق معك تماما في هذه النقطة وفي غيرها من النقاط التي طرحتها.
I agree with you on this point and all other points. Yes, you are correct. But we have suffered many, many types of interferences from countries like Saudi Arabia and many others, as mentioned before, such as the Americans, the British, and in the past from the Soviet Union. In fact, all those hard times in the past is the main reason behind the current revolution in Yemen. We were under colonial powers of Saudis and Americans, which used to designate presidents and prime ministers in here, unfortunately, and even the ministers. They used to control the cultural aspects of Yemen, from some religious parties, takfiris, to political scenes, through some tribal leaders. They used to control the military as well. Even the curriculum at the schools was controlled by them. That was one of the main reasons for the September Revolution, to get rid of this American hegemony that came to our country under the Saudi and Emirati flags. And now, after the Yemeni Revolution and after all these achievements, they have become worried about Yemen being an example for other countries. So they started this war. They wanted to derail or destroy the Yemeni revolution along with some other revolutions during the Arab Springs. Of course, the conflict is very complicated, and we know that the Americans, the Saudis, the British, the Zionists, and the Emiratis are behind it. They don't want Yemen to become an example to the world, but we are determined to do so. The Yemenis have tasted the meaning of freedom and sovereignty. But we, as Yemenis and the resistance movement and the Islamic Republic of Iran, we are masters in this area, and we will not stop at the middle of this path. We have joined hands with the Islamic Republic of Iran, and we are brothers. If you look at the title of the revolution in Yemen, it says it is Yemeni, no East, no West. But when it comes to negotiations, we see Saudis and Emiratis at the other side of the table, unfortunately. So the Yemeni crisis has been revealed to be a 100% American project. Just pay attention to speeches of Mr. Biden and the Saudi statements. There is no Yemeni talking about Yemen outside Yemen. On the other hand, see if any Iranian official talks on behalf of Yemenis. Not at all. This is the difference. The Saudis trying to drag Iranians into negotiation in Iraq about Yemeni issue, but Iranians have been very clear on that, and they were very sincere and honest and have acted decisively on this issue. They keep saying that we are not agents of Yemen, we are not Yemeni nationals, we are not allowed to talk on behalf of Yemenis to solve your problems. Iran tells that if you have problems, go negotiate with Yemenis themselves directly and talk to them. So here we can tell who is the master and who is the slave. There is a saying that goes, it is very difficult to explain what is very clear. But some people do not want to accept that. It is very difficult to explain that sun has light while it has light. It is very clear. Yemen's crisis is crystal clear. But some are still blind or prefer to act blindly. It is a bad thing for them, not for us. They are stupid. Most of them are stupid. And they are trying to distort the fact and the reality about Yemen. It is unfortunate.
Thank you very much, Mr. Ambassador. And on that note, I want to thank you for joining us on Insight, where we discussed Yemen with the ambassador to Tehran, Mr. Ibrahim Al-Daylami. Thank you very much. What insight did we gain from our conversation with Ambassador Al-Daylami? First, as always in history, Yemen's location at the crossroads between East and West will draw the attention of global imperialists seeking to control global seaways. Second, the Yemeni people are attempting to establish a government backed by their own people that is independent of global imperialists. This challenges the existence of Western vassal family dictatorships in the Arab world and is the reason why the U.S. and its vassals in the region are engaging in a quasi-genocide campaign in Yemen involving war crimes, famine, and epidemics. We learned that any people with a minimum amount of dignity will defend themselves if attacked and invaded, something that seems to be considered a virtue by Westerners if it's done by blonde, blue-eyed people in Eastern Europe, but is considered terrorism if done by the Yemeni people. We learned that Yemen's territorial integrity is a red line that the revolutionary government will not accept any peace agreement that would involve the splitting of the country in two. And finally, we came to understand that the relationship between the revolutionary government in Yemen and the Islamic Republic of Iran is a brotherly relationship, something inconceivable to Western elites and various local sheikhs who are used to buying and exploiting proxies and then discarding them when they are no longer needed. Thank you for joining us on this episode. Until the next time on Insight.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Western governments have been heavily subsidizing their own fossil fuel industries, even as they exhort much poorer countries to do more to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. But the full extent of these subsidies has been hidden by the methods used to measure them. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jayati Ghosh, writer. This article is published under the heading, "The Outrageous and Largely Hidden: $5.9 trillion annual subsidy to the fossil fuel industry that is killing people." Stay tuned for more. The latest report from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change should terrify policymakers and ordinary people around the world. The IPCC warns that some disastrous climate outcomes are now likely to occur, not in the distant future, but within the next 15 years or even the next decade. While this may be understandable, the Ukraine crisis has also exposed the excessively short-term policy orientation of Western governments. Many have quickly reneged on even the relatively meager and obviously inadequate climate pledges they made only a few months ago at the United Nations Climate Change Conference in Glasgow. The world is rapidly running out of time to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius and avert a climate catastrophe. U.S. President Joe Biden's administration, after unsuccessfully imploring Saudi Arabia to increase oil production, has promised to release 1 million barrels a day from the U.S. government's strategic reserves for the next 6 months. In Europe, which has been hit much harder by the fallout from the war because of its heavy reliance on natural gas, the talk is not just of more nuclear energy, but also of reviving coal-based power. Coal is by far the dirtiest fossil fuel, and rich countries routinely pillory India for using it. Only those who previously swallowed Western governments in sincere green rhetoric rather than examining the reality should be surprised by this turn of events. These governments have been heavily subsidizing their own fossil fuel industries, even as they exhorted much poorer countries to do more to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. But the full extent of these subsidies has been hidden by the methods used to measure them. The standard way to measure government support for fossil fuel production or consumption is to look at direct budgetary transfers and subsidies, as well as tax breaks for this sector. Using this method, the OECD and the International Energy Agency estimate that governments across 52 advanced and emerging economies, accounting for about 90% of global fossil fuel energy supply, provided fossil fuel subsidies worth an average of $555 billion per year from 2017 to 2019. This support declined to $345 in 2020, mainly because of the collapse in fuel prices and drop in consumption during the COVID-19 pandemic. But even before the Ukraine crisis, there were fears that rebounding fuel prices could push up subsidies as the global economy recovered. Those fears were more than borne out. It turned out that the bleakest estimates massively understand the actual fossil fuel subsidies the government provide. In a recent study, the International Monetary Fund devised a more comprehensive measure that includes both explicit subsidies or undercharging for supply cost. The implicit subsidies or undercharging for environmental costs and foregone consumption taxes. The IMF estimated that global fossil fuel subsidies in 2020 totaled $5.9 trillion, more than 10 times the OECD IEA estimate. This is not surprising. Implicit subsidies accounted for 92% of the total. Under both methodologies, India is a heavy subsidizer of fossil fuels, although lower-income countries can be partly accused given the high cost of green energy transition. But other countries' rankings change in interesting ways when implicit subsidies are considered. These important numbers highlight the extent to which government intervention is skewing prices and therefore market incentives in favor of fossil fuels rather than against them. While governments were supporting the fossil fuel industry to the tune of $5.9 trillion in 2020, the IPCC estimates that global climate finance from both public and private sources totaled only about $640 billion that year. Given this huge disparity, no one should be shocked at the fossil fuel industry's continued resilience. The world is rapidly running out of time to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius and avert a climate catastrophe, but the global economic system and Western governments appear unable to take the threat seriously.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The The UK has announced a controversial deal with Rwanda to send illegal immigrants and asylum seekers to the East African country. The British government claims this scheme, which is worth $156 million, would have stopped smugglers from sending thousands of desperate migrants on dangerous journeys across the English Channel every year. Over 28,000 migrants and refugees have crossed the English Channel in 2021. That's three times higher than the year before. In November last year, 27 people died while trying to reach the UK when their boat sank in the worst disaster to occur on the Channel. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson hailed the deal with Kigali, saying the East African country with a sketchy human rights record is one of the safest countries in the world, globally recognized for its record of welcoming and integrating migrants. Rwanda already hosts some 140,000 refugees in six refugee camps. However, rights groups and refugee organizations swiftly slammed what they called a cruel, inhumane, and neo-colonial plan. They also questioned both its costs to British taxpayers and its effect on migration. According to a recent poll, 60% of the British public is dissatisfied with the Johnson government's migration policy. The UN's refugee agency has also voiced opposition, saying people fleeing persecution should not be treated like commodities. The world body stated that such arrangements simply shift asylum responsibilities, evade international obligations, and are contrary to the letter and spirit of the Refugee Convention. Others have criticized Rwanda's human rights record, accusing the government of torturing, intimidating, and assassinating their political opponents, and persecuting marginalized people. Johnson said the deal will become a new international standard in handling migration, but human rights groups have warned that the plan could set a dangerous trend for other Western countries to adopt their offshore asylum schemes.
Well, Britain has a good history of trading in human beings. As you know, the whole sort of movement of Africans to North America, Britain was a leading player in shipping slaves from Africa to North America and to Caribbean islands. So Britain has a track record of trading in human beings. So one could, if you like, describe it in that manner. But I think the evil aspect of what's really happening in 2022, that may have happened 200 years ago and when later on slavery was banned. But the reality is that perhaps we are living in a new epoch of slavery at this time.
British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has vowed to curb the English Channel crossings. However, there has been a drastic increase in the number of people arriving on British shores on small boats in recent years. The government passed a Nationality and Borders Bill that would make it a criminal offence to enter the UK illegally, and it would introduce life sentences for people smugglers. But the UN's refugee agency criticized the bill, saying it would penalize most refugees seeking asylum in the country and would create an asylum model that undermines established international refugee protection rules and practices. Meanwhile, the refugee deal with Rwanda comes as more Ukrainians arrive in the UK through different visa programs that the Johnson government has rolled out in the wake of the Russia-Ukraine war. Over 55,000 visas have been issued to refugees fleeing the conflict in Ukraine so far. This clearly shows a contradiction between the proposed policy and the British government's attitude toward Ukrainian refugees.
The reality is that the British government is acting in a very racist manner as well. You know, they might say that, okay, it was sort of a media correspondence who depicted the European the Ukrainian refugees in that manner. But the reality is that the implementation of this policy, perhaps it smacks off what I call racism, clear and without any sort of dilution to it.
Unlike what the British government claims, those seeking to cross the English Channel and land on British soil are not illegal economic migrants, but are mainly those who have escaped bloodshed, war and terror. They are people fleeing oppression and violence from Afghanistan, West Asia or even Europe. They're exercising their right under the UN Refugee Convention, which the UK was a founding signatory of, to seek asylum in a country of their choosing. And let's not forget that they are no different from Ukrainian refugees.
Israeli forces have stormed the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in the occupied old city of Al-Quds and attacked the Palestinian worshippers there. The raid began at dawn on Friday when Israeli forces entered the compound through the Moroccan Gate, also known as the Mughrabi Gate, throwing stun grenades and shooting rubber bullets at the crowd indiscriminately. 400 Palestinians were arrested. Media reports said the Israeli forces also attacked paramedics and press crews, chased them in the courtyards of Al-Aqsa Mosque, and beat a number of them. The Palestinian Red Crescent Society reported that 152 fasting Palestinians had been transferred to hospitals in the occupied Al-Quds for injuries as a result of the raid. Following the Friday prayers, people held rallies in the Gaza Strip in solidarity with the Palestinians at the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
They want it for themselves. They want the Palestinians gone. They want Islam to be gone from Palestine and Christianity too, everything except Judaism. So really, they don't mind having this as a flashpoint for them, as a center of dispute. They want this dispute to go on until they win. That's what they're looking for. And every time they bring settlers there to cause trouble, it's part of what they see as a continuing war for their control of the land. That's what this is about.
The regime has stepped up its deadly acts of aggression across the Palestinian territories since the beginning of Ramadan, as a result of which Palestinians put up a stronger resistance to counter the aggression. The events unfolding in the occupied territories are reminiscent of clashes between the Israeli forces and Palestinians in the West Bank last year that led to an 11-day war between the resistance groups in Gaza and Israel. Over 250 Palestinians were killed in the war, many of them were women and children. Observers now believe that more confrontations are imminent. As the pressure mounts, Palestinians have stepped up their retaliatory operations against Israelis. Over the past 3 weeks, Palestinians have carried out 4 such retaliatory operations, killing over a dozen Israelis. Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett has given the regime's forces a free hand to crack down on Palestinians. He has also called on Israeli civilians with gun licenses to carry weapons in public.
They can find ways to make the Israeli occupation painful, and already actually quite a few Israelis over the last decade have emigrated elsewhere. You have Israeli immigration into Europe and the United States and to Australia. Possibly as many as a million Israelis have done that. If the Palestinians can make it painful enough for the Israelis might just disappear.
When some Arab states announced a normalization of ties with Israel, they claimed that their moves will help the Palestinian cause. But the events of the past couple of years have shown that the only contribution their newly established ties with Tel Aviv made to Palestinians has been even more suffering. In the absence of any accountability, Israel is expected to put even more pressure on the people of Palestine. But the Palestinians are indicating that they remain steadfast to keep fighting against the Israeli occupation with or without international support.
Racial tensions are running high in Grand Rapids, Michigan, after police this week released footage of a white officer lying on the back of an unarmed black man, shooting him in the head. Patrick Leoya, 26, was killed on April 4th after a struggle during a traffic stop. State police are investigating the incident. The officer is currently on administrative leave pending the outcome of the investigation. Authorities say he would not be identified unless criminal charges are pressed against him. The family of Leoya called the video of the shooting, quote, the most horrifying thing they've ever seen, and asked for the officer's name to be released. The shooting has led to protests in the area, with activists expressing grief and frustration with years of inaction on policing issues by Grand Rapids leaders.
Given the U.S.'s long history of police brutality, from Rodney King to George Floyd and now today, we can't be shocked. And I think that the black community should and is justified in being angry at the establishment and seeking methods outside of the establishment and the political structure for seeking change.
The fatal shooting of the unarmed black man by the white officer is the latest on a very long list of similar incidents. Police killings of black men have dominated national debates in recent years, particularly after the 2020 murder of George Floyd in Minneapolis, which triggered persistent protests across America. The deep-rooted problem lingers on. So far this year, over 250 people have been fatally shot by on-duty police officers nationwide. The latest case is another bitter reminder that the system in the United States has failed to take measures to resolve the pressing problem. The April 4th shooting has once again brought deadly police violence in America under the spotlight. Civil rights organization, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People, has been quick to react. The NAACP, which tries to advance justice for African Americans, said in a statement that the shooting is horrifying and deeply frustrating because Americans had meaningful legislation designed to avoid exactly what they are witnessing in this week's police video. It said the involved officer has blood on his hands, and so do the senators who killed the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act. The piece of legislation was passed by the U.S. House of Representatives in March 2021, but bipartisan negotiations in the U.S. Congress over the police reform bill ended in stalemate. The sweeping legislation was passed by the House amid outcry after the murder of George Floyd. It would have banned chokeholds and qualified immunity for law enforcement. It would have also created national standards for policing in an effort to increase accountability.
Lack of efforts to reform the system that are coming from the top. There's no real incentive for legislators to reform when they are benefiting off of the corrupt policing system and corrupt judicial system that this country has. There's also a lack of struggle in the organizations, a lack of structure in the organizations that are struggling against police brutality.
The failure to pass the police reform has been considered as a setback for the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden, who had energetically supported the legislation. President Biden has faced growing calls to sign an executive order to reform the police, but has failed to act. Experts believe ethnic minorities in America, especially African Americans, are facing a very deep-rooted problem that will not be resolved anytime soon. Observers have largely attributed this to the racist roots of American policing and social structures.
Nearly 7 weeks have passed since the start of the war in Ukraine. Russia is now focusing on taking territory in the eastern regions of the country. Ukraine and Russia are building up their military forces in the eastern regions of Donetsk and Luhansk.
It's a very serious situation. The fact that the Russian forces are there have made significant moves, especially in the east of Ukraine and other parts, is unacceptable to the United States, and they're not prepared to negotiate. And I believe that their advice to Zelensky, docked again to Biden today, to assured him of about, 130 million dollars more worth of equipment. that they want them to continue fighting, to continue resisting, but they're not going to send any troops there.
Over the past weeks, Ukraine has enjoyed the support of Western powers, especially the United States. Western nations have sent different types of weapons to Ukraine worth millions of dollars. The U.S. is to announce $750 million in new military aid for Ukraine. The new military aid package would likely include military equipment such as unmanned surface vehicles, Mi-17 helicopters, howitzers, and protective equipment against possible chemical attacks. The Pentagon has hosted leaders from the top 8 U.S. weapons manufacturers to discuss the industry's capacity to help arm Ukraine, even if Russia's invasion lasts as long as 2 years.
So there will be a lot more people dying because the United States is insistent, I think, that Putin's forces have to be forced out of Ukraine before this is all over. And it's not going to be happening anytime soon.
Resupplying as well as planning for a longer war were expected to be discussed at the meeting. The Pentagon has said smaller systems such as Javelin anti-tank missiles and Stinger anti-aircraft missiles have proved to be the most useful weapons. Washington and its Western allies have been shipping these weapons to Ukraine on a nearly daily basis. A partnership between Lockheed Martin and Raytheon Technologies makes the anti-tank Javelin. Raytheon manufactures the Stinger, which shoots down aircraft. Ukraine is ramping up its campaign for military aid even as the U.S. accelerates shipments of weapons to Kiev. Arms lobbyists and their underlings in Congress and the Pentagon are scrambling now to unlock more funds for the military-industrial complex to pump out weapons to Europe.
Unless there are other parties within the world community and also even within NATO to resist this type of policy, it's going to be a very long and costly war. And the cost is going to be borne by the world community, which will suffer in increasing food prices, increasing energy, increasing starvation for millions of people.
But amid the unanimous support for Ukraine, there are critical voices that have been raised against supplying weapons to Ukraine. It's argued that the money channeled to the military industry is used to fuel more bloodshed in Ukraine. Hawks in the West lobby recklessly for NATO to impose a no-fly zone over Ukraine.
They believe that a world empire effectively can be created, in which the United States is the fundamental maker of the rules. Now, every attempt to create an empire in the world has ended up in either failure or disaster. They haven't learned those lessons.
That could be a direct military confrontation between Russia and Ukraine. It's also feared that a nuclear war is also becoming a possibility. A recent poll has shown that the U.S. is being drawn into an all-out war with Russia.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common. Environmental protection is one of the most fundamental and essential tasks in the country.
March 6th, 2022. Another point that is also related to the Environment Protection Organization is preventing the utilization of agricultural lands for other purposes. We have heard that in many cases, agricultural lands in the vicinity of cities and in some plains are used for other purposes. This should be stopped because it is surely to the disadvantage of national interest. Agricultural lands should be expanded. Of course, this is not only the responsibility of the Environment Protection Organization. The Ministry of Agriculture and some other organizations are influential in this regard. Another issue which is also related to the environment is the development of non-fossil energies. The energies which are not reliant on oil, energies such as the nuclear energy, which is increasingly being used in the world. In our region, many different countries are moving towards the nuclear energy. Solar, wind, and other such energies are essential.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The Environment Protection Organization is responsible in this regard, but other organizations such as the Energy Ministry and others have a very important role in this regard as well. All of them must carry out their duty. Therefore, work in environmental areas is fundamental work at the national level. This is something that concerns national interest, and therefore it is everyone's responsibility. Executive officials should pay attention to this matter as well. By God's favor, they will do so. Of course, all big endeavors are carried out with the public's backing. Today is tree planting day, and all the people can be influential in this regard, in the true sense of the word. They should plant and preserve trees and prevent the disappearance of trees and gardens that exist in and out of cities. They should expand plants and good and beneficial vegetation on a daily basis. This is the people's work. They can completely participate in it and help the administration and officials. By God's favor, they will accomplish this. Once more, I wish to congratulate all the dear people and all the addressees of these statements on this Eid, and I ask Allah the Exalted to bestow health on everyone. Greetings be upon you, and God's mercy and blessings.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
in the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As a reminder, you heard that Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, lived in Yakhshal Ghazi neighborhood of Qom for 20 years, and the house had turned into a center of knowledge and political struggles of the Imam. In fact, the father of the Islamic Revolution authored many of his books and also composed a remarkable part of his poems in the same house. Imam Khomeini and his wife experienced many sweet and bitter events in this house. However, writing of the book Kashful Asrar was a very effective event during those years, which we are going to touch upon in this episode. Stay tuned, please. Kashful Asrar, or Uncovering of Secrets, was the name of a book which Imam Khomeini wrote in response to some religious and ideological ambiguities that had been raised in 1944 by a certain Ali Akbar Hakamizadeh in his blasphemous book 1000 Years Secrets. Hakamizadeh was a student of seminary but had reactionary and deviated thoughts. He had lived with Kasravi, an anti-religious figure. Under the influence of Kasravi, Hakamizadeh left the seminary and went to the U.S. while he no more wore the clergy clothes. Hakamizadeh had authored the book 1000 Year Secrets in order what he considered to remove superstitions from Islam. Yet, the book fomented rifts among people and made people suspicion on the authenticity of Islam. The publication of the book caused special jurisprudential and political debates among ulema and the seminary students. Nevertheless, it was Imam Khomeini who sensed the danger of this blasphemous and seditionist book and wrote Kashful Asrar to show the Shia clergy community's serious reaction to the conspiracy. Imam Khomeini's responses to Hakamizadeh were so broad and harsh that he hid with no trace in history. Imam Khomeini answered the anti-religious, anti-clergy propaganda of the book 1000 Years Secrets. He discussed historical events and critically discussed the views of the ancient and contemporary Greek philosophers to emphasize the rightfulness and constructive role of the Shia ulema and seminaries. Imam Khomeini's book not only defended the Shia ideas, but revealed the basis of his political practice in the years of a struggle. The Imam explicitly says in the book that the only legitimate rule is the divine rule. In response to Hakamizadeh's claim that there is no reason to say that a jurisprudent is entitled to rule, Imam Khomeini wrote that the jurisprudential principles are mainly the narrations and hadith of the infallible imams, and they, in turn, are connected to the Prophet and the divine revelation. The Imam deducted from a number of hadith that so it is clear that those who narrate the practice and hadith of the Prophet are the Prophet's representatives, and whatever is proved for the Prophet of the necessity to obey them, velayat and rule are proved for them. Because if a ruler introduces a representative for himself, it means he must do his jobs in his absence. Imam Khomeini's wife, Ms. Khadija Saghafi, was closely witnessing the Imam's concerns over the book 1,000 Year Secrets. He says to this, "This is the Imam's thought, the Imam who thinks in this way on rule, studies, and teaches Irfan, you know, Islamic Gnosticism. You know that those who pursue the issues of philosophy and Gnosticism are not after such things like rule and vice versa. But he has staged uprising in two fronts. Firstly, in the front of a struggling, the sanctimonious who washed the jar that our son Mustafa had drunk water from because the Imam was a teacher of philosophy. However, the Imam stood against these towns and taught philosophy and clashed with the thought which considered philosophy as haram and opened the way for the next teachers. On the other hand, he was preoccupied with formation of the Islamic rule and didn't stop for a moment to establish God's religion. As for the tough issues which occurred during political events, he would intervene, but he would spend his effort and talent in studying and discussion, as he believed that there were great ulema at the seminary and basic responsibility is up to them, and he should get prepared for the future, and he had to study to achieve easier what he was thinking about. One of the moral characteristics of Imam Khomeini was the high respect he observed for the ulema and jurisprudence of seminary while writing the book Uncovering of Secrets, Kashf al-Asrar, although he was opposed to some of their political thoughts. His wife says that he always had a combative spirit. During the reign of Reza Khan, he was constantly in pain and hardship. When Reza Khan wanted to remove turbans, the Imam was among those who spent days in gardens and nights in his room. He was not a person to surrender to Reza Khan with such threats. Late Sheikh Abdul Karim, who believed in silence, hadn't been able to force the spirit of this unyielding man to be silent against Reza Khan's coercion. Although he himself behaved so and trained some on his basis, a group of others who were few in number, and Mr. Khomeini was among them, didn't accept his method. She continues, "The defenseless people would go and give the reports of injustices of the agents of Reza Khan, and Sheikh Abdul Karim would keep silent as if nothing had happened. He believed that silence was better. At the time of the seminary students' exams, which had been determined by the regime, the Sheikh not only didn't prevent them, but he encouraged them to take the exams. The Imam had differences with late Ayatollah Burujerdi too, but he would never say anything, as he considered respect the respect of Islam. He would always respect Grand Ayatollah Sheikh Abdul Karim too." Here, Imam Khomeini's wife has pointed to the exams of seminary students, which was related to the law that had been passed during Reza Khan's reign for exempting from military service only the students who could pass the exam which the regime would give. This way, it was the court mullahs who proved the scientific qualification of students, not the great teachers and sources of emulation.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
People in the port city of Karachi hit the streets to voice their outrage at the ouster of the elected government. The protesters say the US conspired against their country. While Imran Khan never sought sore ties with any nation during his short-lived premiership.
Former Prime Minister Imran Khan has accused Biden administration in Washington for toppling his government in Pakistan, for not towing US's line on foreign policy.
Khan said that his life is in danger, but he prioritizes Pakistan's independence over his life.
Imran Khan had twice tweeted, or in fact more, but he had a clear clear message for the US administration that we are partners in peace. We will always be partners in peace. We are partners in trade. We'll always be partners in trade with the whole world, with everybody. But we will not take dictation from anybody.
I'm here specifically to do my part in wanting and executing the Pakistan that we all want. And I think Imran Khan represents a vision of that Pakistan. And I personally, honestly think it's not his job alone to do this. It's our job, our responsibility to come out and do this for ourselves. That's why I'm here.
We've gathered here because of the sovereignty of Pakistan, and we want Pakistan to get justice and Imran Khan to get justice, and we don't believe in the fake government.
Khan says U.S. diplomats started meeting some Pakistani officials 4 months ago, adding that Pakistan's ambassador to the U.S. was threatened.
We've gathered here to fight for a more democratic Pakistan, to fight for a free and independent Pakistan, to fight for a Pakistan that doesn't get bullied. That is our main reason for being here, for standing up for Pakistan, its sovereignty, and its integrity.
We're just here to support Imran Khan in this freedom fight. We are here to just, we don't accept the imported government. We're here to support our Prime Minister Imran Khan. He came here with the elected votes our votes.
It's a protest for democracy. It's a protest for justice and for rights and human rights. The world, people choose their own leaders. Every citizen has a choice, has a right to choose their own people who they want to govern over them.
Khan has called for a snap election and urged an investigation into what he calls the US's plot to topple his government. He has become the first Pakistani prime minister to be removed from office through a non-confidence vote by the parliament. Mohammad Turi, Karachi.
Palestinians rallied in the besieged Gaza Strip on Sunday to mark the 48th anniversary of Palestinian Prisoners' Day.